Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with Dr. Christopher Kerr. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Chris, of the people who are at the dying stage, what generally is taking them down? What affliction do they have? Is it cancer?
Yeah, it was pretty representative across the board. Cancer, certainly a number, but a lot of heart and lung disease as well. And more we're seeing people live longer with multiple comorbidities. But yes, cancer is highly represented.
Have you ever seen a patient pull out of it completely where everybody thought that, including them, that they were going to die and they still kept going?
Yeah, I've seen a few in my life. I think that oftentimes there was a misdiagnosis, but there are certainly kind of unexplainable changes in the trajectory of certain people's illness. Yeah.
Explain how they find love and insight with this pre-death situation that comes to them in dreams and visions. How does that come? What creates it?
I think a couple of things are important. One is they describe these experiences as virtual or lived. They're not merely memories. So it has this lived feeling to it. And with that, because of the themes, they're reconnecting with people they loved, a parent, a child, that they feel a sense of being restored, of feeling lost love that kind of returns to them. Of being put back together, and that's really the meaning of it.
Is there anything religious about this at all with them?
You know, this is something we wrestled with, but others have reported the same thing. We don't see a lot of reference to the symbols of religion, but certainly with the tenets of the faith. So if the tenets of faith are love and forgiveness, those are the overarching themes.
The family members, the people who, of course, are related to the person who's dying, how do they react with all of this?
So we've done 2 studies involving about 750 bereaved family members. And the best way to say it is that what's good for the patient is also good for their loved one. How people leave us matters, whether we see death as something just as a physical lessening or suffering, or whether we see something else that's not as empty and as limiting. And so I think that, if you have two partners and someone's dying in the bed and they lost a child decades earlier and the person in the bed's referencing that child, that very much changes how death is viewed. Rather than something that's empty, it's full of something with meaning, and that's what our survey showed. In fact, we looked at an instrument that measures how people grieve in healthy versus unhealthy ways, and people who witnessed these experiences absolutely remembered differently, moved on differently, were able to recall differently. So it's a very healthy thing.
Chris, have you videotaped many of the patients?
Yeah, we have. It was, as I mentioned, it was meant for doctors, and we knew everyone would have this preconceived bias about what a dying patient looked like, right? That they would be feeble-minded, confused. So we were very deliberative in filming patients. And it's kind of funny because it was meant for physicians and lecturers, and it ended up as part of a Netflix docuseries and a PBS documentary.
Do most of the people who are at the dying stage think that there's life after death?
You know, it's a great question. And we were really careful not to delve into the interpretation of this. So we were just wanted to take their words and experiences and transcribe it. Because you could go to a number of directions, right? You go towards religion, afterlife, paranormal, etc. I think what's most important is they didn't get a sense of finality. They don't talk in those terms. They don't talk in terms of fear. I guess the best way to say it is there's something within the dying that's actually life-affirming. So it doesn't deny that dying's occurring, but rather instead it affirms the life that was led.
Knowing what you know, what generally would be more acceptable to be knowing you're dying and you'd have a few weeks to prepare, you know, through these insights, or to somebody who just dies suddenly and they're gone?
Oh, I would prefer the former for a few reasons. I think it's a completely different injury to leave people abruptly. I think that there's important living to do in the dying process. I think we see some of the best of our human nature. We see people who may not have hope for cure, but their hope transitions to other people. There's gestures of love. There's selflessness. So I think that it's meant to be that way, and that's so profound living. Goes, and we see this in caregiving. You know, people are going along with their lives and all of a sudden they stop and the adult child is now caring for their parent who needs them. So we see incredible acts of kindness, of compassion. And, you know, what our caregivers will say is it's kind of the best, hardest thing they ever did. So I think depriving people of all of that, of saying what needs to be said, of sharing the very special moments together, of remembrance. I think that's really important. So yeah, no, I think it's much harder to die suddenly. It leaves a different wound.
What have you learned by this process that you didn't know prior to?
I think I trained in a very traditional medical model, and I saw dying as almost medical failure, as a problem to solve, and I looked at it in terms of organ function rather than what it really is, a very human event and a closing of a life. I certainly didn't start with a bias towards trying to understand or appreciate the spiritual aspects of living and dying. And I think, you know, you can't come out of this without being very moved by all of that. I think there's a better story. I think that I'm just so impressed with how people do this and what they're capable of. So I learned a lot.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do any of those that are ready to die talk about being visited by other dead relatives or family members to kind of comfort them?
Yeah, that's the majority of the reports we get. Far and away. So we ask people on a menu list, you know, pick what it is you're seeing, and far and away. And that was actually the most predictive variable of impending death. So not only do the frequencies of these pre-death dreams and visions increase as people get close to death, but most importantly, they focus on specifically on people who they've loved and lost. And when we ask them to measure comfort as in terms of what they were seeing the deceased gave them the greatest comfort. And there's just some fascinating features, and this comes out in our videos. You know, very little is said between the dreamer and the person in the dream, but everything seems to be understood or implied. So we see 95-year-old men who lost their mother when they were five, which, you know, it's her presence that they feel, smell the perfume, the cooking in the kitchen. So all of this remembrance, this idea of being put back together. So seeing the deceased is overwhelmingly comforting, highly predictive of impending death.
What can you conclude by that, the fact that they see their loved ones who have passed on?
I think it's a great question. I think where I end up is this. I think I'm impressed that time and distance seem to kind of vanish, and that those who we've loved, who have been so formative to us, are never really gone. They're still accessible. They're still proximate to us. And the depth of that feeling doesn't vanish. It does when we're well and it's a distant memory, but not towards the end. It seems to come back to people in a very profound way.
Does the age, Chris, of the person who's dying have anything to do with how they react?
Very much. There's absolutely a difference between people whose lives are kind of unfinished. So somebody who has young children, when others are dependent on you, I think that that's a different burden as to opposed to somebody who's their ninth decade, who's tired, who many of the people who they loved have died, whose quality of life is diminished. There's a different level of ease and grace. Very different.
Do you see a difference between people with various ailments, dementia versus cancer or anything like that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. People who are kind of neurodifferent, such as dementia, they'll often do this in very interesting ways. You know, we have a fascinating video of a daughter whose mother was very advanced dementia, a dementia unit, actually. And towards the end of her life, her husband had predeceased her. And towards the end of her life, every time she closed her eyes, she would relive the love that she shared with her husband in a way that it was experienced. So the daughter would go see her demented mother, and she'd just be full of life and love and laughter, and she had a foot more in that world with her deceased husband. And towards the end, we live near Niagara Falls, the wedding capital, and so yeah. Towards the end, the woman, the mother with dementia, is caught trying to leave the building. This is days before death, because she was trying to get to her husband because it was her wedding day. So again, the most meaningful parts of living had come to her. And what's fascinating is where you would expect escalating kind of psychological distress from, you know, worsening physical conditions, she's dying. Instead, she's feeling reclaimed love. And of course, the effect this had on the daughter was immense. Because what this tends to do is connect us to one another, daughter to mother to deceased father, so that lives, whether they're living or dead, are remain interwoven because they kind of return to them.
What did you learn about this that you did not know before?
I thought, as a physician, I thought of dying in terms of in physical dimensions, without really any appreciation that the patient, the view from the bed was different. I was looking at a body, and yes, I was concerned whether there was pain or nausea, but I didn't have an appreciation that the person who's dying had a view and a perspective and an experience and an inner experience that really I would have no appreciation of. And what was fascinating, I think what got me truly interested in this, I was almost off put by it at the beginning. I'm not naturally bent towards this stuff, but what was so undeniable was that it was clearly so therapeutic for people. And so who was I to discount it or get stuck on where does it come from, you know, where's the source of this? I think what ultimately matters is not that I understand it, but that it matters to our patients.
How many die without pain, Christopher?
Oh, the vast majority of our patients die without pain. Pain is probably the, if you were told, for example, you had a terminal illness, I think one of the, instinctively, our mind immediately goes to fear of suffering. But nature takes care of a lot of this. So there's not many pains that we don't get the upper hand on And a lot of the pains take care of themselves. You know, people who have pain getting around are now bedbound, etc. I think what we see more of is confusional states, delirium, than we do physical pain that we can't manage.
If you were to do your studies over, is there anything you would alter, or would you keep things the same?
Yeah, no, I would. And I think we're doing that now. I think we would ask better questions, deeper questions. So, you know, what do these experience, how do these experience inform you? What does this change, for example, about what you think about dying or what goes beyond death? So you try to get a better understanding of how the patient makes sense of this. We did a really interesting study where we looked at, there's a scale, a measurement for post-traumatic growth. So the idea that you can be in a negative experience like war, but still have, there's positive experience and growth in it.
Right.
For example, friendships that from the camaraderie of being in war. And we looked at that with dying patients who were having these experiences, and it was fascinating. They did show growth. So even though they're diminishing and fading from us, they're growing and adapting and gaining insights largely from these experiences. So I think that's fascinating. So I think the meaningfulness to having the patient define that for us becomes very important. And that's across the board. So what does this mean, for example, for your religious convictions? Your thoughts on continued consciousness, those sort of things.
Were you shocked by any of the results?
Yeah, almost all of them.
Huh.
I continue to be blown away by how the people can recall with such vividness earlier experiences that might otherwise be lost.
I get it.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on Season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.